But part of the difficulty is also about the fact that he wrote against the background of an older mythical and poetic view of the world, which was still vital in Plato's time, even if already being ironically appropriated in Plato. And we can see this, that as Plato moves in a world of myth in a way that later thinkers didn't find themselves comfortable, or at least later philosophical thinkers didn't find themselves nearly so comfortable doing. And it's very often difficult for us to see exactly the ways in which Plato's imagination is working. But a major part of the difficulty is he wrote about things that are extraordinarily difficult. And he treats them with subtlety and with sophistication. And this, although it represents a difficulty in reading Aristotle, is at the same time the source of one of the great rewards of reading him. When you encounter somebody with that kind of intelligence and that kind of wit, the kind that you will find if you read Plato, approaching topics that are difficult, but treating them with subtlety, with wit, with sophistication, with finesse, it's enormously rewarding. Plato, like Aristotle, is an early philosopher, but he's not, whatever this might mean, a primitive philosopher. It might be instructive here to think, by way of analogy, how sophisticated a poet Homer, for example, is. If you've listened to the Homeric poems, you know that Homer is already the inheritor of a long and developed poetic tradition, and is not, in any sense, a primitive poet. Well, the same is true of Plato, and it would be a mistake for us to read him as of interest only because he's our, as it were, philosophical ancestor to whom we must do homage, but whose mistakes need to be cleared up. And this is what it means to take him seriously, to read him as a philosophical master from whom we have much to learn. Now, lastly, there's another reason why Plato is difficult. Plato was a philosopher who was a dramatic poet. The dialogues are all mimetic, that is to say, they're fictional. No real argument takes place, but rather a series of fictional imitation arguments that are not in the mouths of Plato. One of the remarkable things about Plato is that, in a sense, he can be said to speak nowhere in the dialogues. They're in the mouths of other people, Socrates, Critias, Charmides, each of whom is saying something. This fact is sometimes expressed as connected with Socratic irony. Well, it may be. It's irony in some much broader sense that I think is essential to poetic uses of language, and most obviously dramatic poetry, and is labeled by Plato in a seminal passage in The Republic as the style of discourse that is thought of as mimetic, namely the creation of a persona or series of personae who say things that have certain orthodox meanings, but such that the meaning of the work in which these things are embedded, a poem or a drama, for example, is refracted and transposed from that simple projected meaning. What this means is that we must always go beyond the argument that we're looking at to ask ourselves the question, what does Plato intend by having this argument take place? Why does he have his characters put it forward at this time and in this place, in the dialogue? And why is it put forward by this person? And how does it fit within the context of the other arguments that are taking place? The fact is connected with and raises specific questions about the vexed questions of where Plato's views are and what their relations are to the views, say, of Socrates. So the dialogue in this sense, the dialogues that we're going to be looking at, for example. The dialogue is an instrument in Plato's hands, and it's necessary always that we be sensitive to what the philosophical point is that's being made by the dialogue and not simply in the dialogue. Consider as an analogy Shakespeare's plays. There are views within these plays about many things that get expressed by the characters, about astrology, about kingship, about love, nature. Which of these views are Shakespeare's? Well, his views, Shakespeare's views, in contrast to the views of any one of his characters, are difficult to come by. One has got to read the whole play, and you have to think the relationship among the views expressed, and think the relationship of the views expressed to the character. That is, finally, if you're going to think about what, if it is the case that Shakespeare has views about astrology, if you're going to think what those are, you're going to have to discover what leads a character, say like Edmund or Gloucester in King Lear, to say what it is that they say. And the same thing is true about Plato. If we're going to understand Plato's views, we're going to have to read beyond any excerpt that we might take. We're going to have to enhance our ability to understand the entire context and the entire dialogue in which we find this particular passage. And characteristically, it will be a mistake to quote a piece of Plato's dialogue and say, well, Plato thought such and such, without seeing the way in which it's embedded in the entire context. It would be like saying, well, Shakespeare thought that you should neither a borrower nor a lender be, because Shakespeare put that in the mouth of that sententious character, Polonius. Sometimes we tend to forget this, because sometimes we tend to read Socrates as Plato's spokesperson.